Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had $1 million. If I had
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tim Allen. Andrew on the board. We should have Mr. Kevin O'Neill with us. And Jimmy Lawler came in this morning because he wanted to help Kevin and I talk about Ryan Sandberg and some of the crazy stuff that's going on with sports because Ryan was a big story. Kevin, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing okay.
I'm glad to see you. Did we talk to our buddy Dave Murphy today? Find out if he's in the way of the tsunami now? Do you really want to live in California? See, we got fires, we got
always
floods.
Threatening to it's disaster central, let's put it that way.
Yeah, now, you never thought that... Now, if you only had a tsunami when the fires were coming through there, you'd have been okay, right?
Would have doused them.
God. Tsunami waves have reached California.
I think I heard this morning that they've downgraded it from a warning to a watch, so for what that's worth.
Well, it says they tsunami waves have reached California. Several hours after a powerful 8.8 God, how fast do those things move, Kevin? Several hours between Russia and
faster than I can swim, that's for damn sure.
Yeah. Waves in Japan have ranged from 30 centimeters to 1.3 meters, so I'm saying it's pretty light in California. Wednesday said a tsunami waves measuring 1.6 feet above tide level have been observed in Arena Cove, whatever the hell that is. Hawaii, waves were 4.9 feet above tide level. That's a lot. Well, there you go. We figured we'd talk a little bit about Mr. Sandberg today, as well as other stuff that's going on in the world. By the way, we have the Fed meeting today, and that's going to be interesting because, I'm going to talk about different schools of thought, guys. The Fed has been... I don't know if I even mentioned it yesterday, but the money supply numbers came out, and these are the June numbers now. We don't get the weeklies, you know. Let's not go into that. How much I'm pissed off about that, I think it was the Biden administration that did it, and of course, the Trump administration hasn't given people the weekly numbers like they used to. But I'm just such a sinister ass that I think they're still making the numbers, and somebody are getting them, just not us. You know, I don't know if that's I want to say I'm 90% sure on that accusation, but because I don't think the guys that do the weekly money supplies at the Fed all of a sudden got fired and don't compile the numbers because they sure need them. Anyway.
Well, yeah, they need them, but they do them daily. So
I'm saying, but I mean, I don't think they're in a closed room in a safe, Kevin. I think other people are getting them. If you know what I mean. Anyway, if you look at the June numbers. Money supply has grown at a 7.4 yearly pace. If anybody thinks that that's fighting inflation or isn't expansionary, they really need to see a shrink or something. So which begs the question, if the Fed's doing that and they're pouring money into the system and you're seeing those short-term rates actually drop a little anyway, the reluctance to actually say you're doing it and drop it a quarter point, nobody I talked to, Kevin, nobody. I mean, I was on a Joan Esposito show yesterday, and nobody even thinks about the money supply, money stock like that. It's all just interest rates. So these guys could run the funds rate down to like zero, and if they don't say they're doing it, nobody believes they did it. We've told an entire generation has lost all knowledge of this, it appears, except for old farts that happen to go to the University of Chicago like me. I mean, nobody even knows what you're talking about. when you say you can't just look at the interest rates, you got to look at the money supply, because one is kind of a function of the other. What are you talking about? You even mentioned it, you see everybody's eyes glaze over. But anyways,
listen. Well, and isn't that, you know, ultimately when you talk about interest rates, that, you know, that's the old, you know, that's not the target. The target is the money supply, even if you're doing interest rates. So,
well, the money supply is what moves the interest rates, or a way of keeping score.
No, I don't even think it's that. I think it's cause and effect.
Well, I mean, if you think the rates are too high, all of a sudden last night there was tightness in the federal funds rate, meaning banks had trouble borrowing from other banks, and you put more money in the system the next day, that rate will sneak down a little bit. So you head more toward your target, or the other way around. If you put too much in, then you can pull a little out. It's the management of the system. That's why they say the target rate is between 4.25 to 4.5. Anywhere in there, they're fine. It's never going to be, if they say it's 4.5, it's never, well, once in a blue moon, it's going to be 4.50. Otherwise, it's going to be 4.49, you know, 4.53, something like that. But their target is there, correct?
Yeah, and all I'm saying is if you manipulate the money supply, it's going to show up. It's going to affect interest rates. And if you manipulate interest rates, it's going to affect the money supply. It is all cause and effect.
But the interest rate we're talking about here, now, we're not talking about 30 or 10 or even 5. We're talking about the federal funds rate where one bank lends to another overnight, which, of course, now has been kind of superseded because the Fed has so much money that people are depositing stuff back at the Fed, and there's so much money in the system that's gotten a little sloppy. But in theory, if the Fed poured so much money in where they dropped the short-term rate down to 1%, and everybody goes, oh, man, that's going to cause nothing but inflation, the long-term rates would actually go up, which is not being told by anybody anywhere. Anyway, that's going to be around for a while. Let's just say there's a, they said yesterday, there's no joy in Mudville, Ryan Sandberg, because we just set the tone here a little bit for you guys, because I was, and Kevin, you noticed, and so do you, Jimmy, but when I first came down to the trading floor, I used to go to Cub games from the south side, believe it or not, and I'd go to Sox games from the south side. Well, we take the bus up there. During the week, there was never, the upper deck was never open unless it was opening day, right, Kevin? And so you'd walk in, and everybody's downstairs. I mean, the upper deck were, I don't even think there were reserved seats up there. Well, there were, but I mean, you couldn't use them during the week. And my buddy Big Dan had weekends and opening day, weekends and holiday tickets. And he was in the upper deck. He had first seat, upper, first row upper deck, looking right down at third baseline. Beautiful seats. And then when I came down to the trading floor, all of a sudden there was a, all of a sudden one night, the Cubs had a little reception over in the Berghoff basement. Free beer. Free chow, so of course everyone went over there. And the guy was selling tickets to what they just came up with, these 305 games. They still didn't have any lights. So the idea was they were going to have, I'm going to say 15, maybe 20 305 games, and they were trying to sell tickets for that. But now the upper deck is back in play because it's going to be open for those games. And this is 1981-ish, 82-ish, and just so happened, 1982, they traded for Ryan Sandberg. And they got him from the Phillies, and this was it when, what was the guy's name? General manager Kevin?
Dallas Green.
Dallas Green had been the manager of the Phillies. He had kind of had this phobia about getting former Philly guys that he liked on the Cubs, because the Cubs kind of had nobody.
Yeah, so they got Larry Boa, they got Sarge.
You know, no, it was the next year they got Sarge.
Okay.
But this particular trade was Ivan DeJesus, who was a pretty good shortstop for the Cubs, for Larry Boa, who was maybe not quite as good, but a fiery player and maybe a little older.
It was an age trade.
And Sandberg was sort of the throw-in pick. But Sandberg was, he had played a few games for Philly, but everybody says, well, he was a 20th-round draft pick that essentially beat all odds. Well, that's, like most stories in sports, Kevin, it's a hunk of BS, because the reason why he drafted the 20th round is he sort of committed, I don't think he fully signed a letter of intent, to play quarterback for Washington State.
Well, even if he did sign the letter of intent, it's only binding to him playing football in college. He could still go play baseball.
But he just never went to Washington State. He just went right to the Phillies. Right.
Yeah, and he was a Parade All-American quarterback.
Yeah.
And in those days, Parade Magazine, which came out weekly with your with your Sunday paper. If I recall, it was the Sun-Times that carried it. This was before recruiting became a cottage industry. And so that was sort of like when you hear about a McDonald's All-American today in basketball, that, you know, Parade would do basketball and football All-American teams, and that was the big prestigious designation that people had in high school. So it was a big deal. In other words, he was not, you know, it wasn't that he was just this good quarterback that was going to go to Washington State. It was that he could have had his pick of wherever he wanted to go to school.
I don't know. I think he played basketball too, or did I read that wrong?
Yeah, he was a three-sport guy.
Which, of course, nobody is anymore, right? Because you've got to lock in on one, but which is, yeah, really, I think,
very few. There's still some, and there's, you know, and certainly there's a lot of two-sport guys. So, you know, they always talk about, you know, will this guy play basketball after the football season's over? And the answer to that is nowadays is no, not if your team's any good, because you're going to be playing in January, and by the time you get to January, if a guy is going to even take a week off between sports, but by the time he is integrated into your team in any meaningful way, you're well into February and towards the end of the season. It's just not, as a practical matter, it's not likely to happen unless the guy is just really a star basketball player. The last ones I remember were Julius Peppers and I think it was Ronnie Curry at North Carolina, and that was because their football team sucked and they were done at Thanksgiving.
Don't you hate it when that happens?
So, you know, no bowl games, no none of that kind of stuff. So Thanksgiving or the first week of December, and so they went ahead and played basketball. But other than that, you just don't see that very often.
Kevin, the baseball players, or Jimmy, the baseball players, I remember Samardzija, you know, he was a pitcher, but he still went to the football, you know, spring practice and all that stuff. When's the last time you saw, like, a position player from the football team play the whole season in baseball? It'd be a lot.
Oh, no, they had some. What was the wide receiver's name for Notre Dame that played? Cole Kmet played baseball at Notre Dame.
Okay.
He was an outfielder. Pat Connaughton pitched, a basketball player.
But, I mean, the pitchers, unless I'm trying to get at, I mean, they're still going to do the football stuff in the meeting. They still have the how's this for a bad term? The pecking order in sports were, just to explain this real quickly, that if you are on a football ride, this is going back a ways, you could go play baseball or soccer or something like that. But if you were on a soccer ride, used to be when you go get your kicker from the soccer team, can't do that anymore because the football scholarship is considered a superior scholarship. So if somebody's there on a soccer scholarship or a baseball scholarship or even a basketball scholarship, if you go put them on a football team, you got to switch that scholarship over to a football ride, right, Kevin, and count toward your football rides?
Or else they had to play a full season on the soccer field before they could play football on scholarship.
Is it football, basketball, baseball, soccer? Is that the pecking order?
I don't know, and I don't know if they still do it that way, because I do recall, and now I'm trying to remember the kid's name, who's a wide receiver on the Notre Dame football team who was there on a lacrosse scholarship.
I'll bet he now has a football scholarship. I mean, in the old days he would have had to. Anyway,
right. He's an important player on the lacrosse team, too.
Anyway, to get back to the Sandberg thing, well, I went to this thing, and everybody bought the 305 games from the floor. And if you beat feet out of the index pit at 3 o'clock and hopped on the L, you'd miss, like, two innings. Biggest parties ever on Earth. You think, now, how about there's parties after the game? We could have taught these people how to party. The bleacher place across the bar across the way, they would just take over the entire intersection. The police would show up with horses on a Friday night. Friday night 305 games could have been the biggest party the city's ever seen. Every week, never a problem, never a gun, never anything. Just a lot of people drinking a lot of beer. But then they said, okay, you can't do that anymore. We're gonna actually have full-time seats. So Dan and I said, okay, I'll get rid of the, there weren't going to be no more weekends and holidays, no more than 305. So we ended up splitting the season package. That's how we ended up in the season package. We kind of combined our 305. This is probably 83, 84. And I think our first year, Kevin and Jimmy, the first row upper deck. What's that, Jimmy? In infield upper deck boxes or something they call those. I mean, I what the hell?
Terrace boxes.
Terrace boxes.
Yes, and, upper deck terrace.
I think they were $350 Don's first year, but the person who sort of, I won't say he caused all this, but put the future in with the Cubs was Ryan Sandberg. He wasn't just a ball player. He was a sign that the whole thing was turning around. The park, the neighborhood, the fandom, the whole bit. And I if it wasn't him, it might have been able to be somebody else, but it wasn't. It was him. Am I correct on this, both of you guys? What do you think? Am I nuts on this or no?
Well, I think you're nuts.
Well, yeah, absolutely. But I used to go to spring training in those years. The next year, 83, they didn't have the world's best year either. And all of a sudden, 84, he started to get a little better, and Dallas Green made this trade for, Ron Say came in 83, right? And they managed to get a few good years out of him. But that's when they did the, was it, it was, you're right, it was Boa, that in that particular trade. It was Boa and Sarge, right?
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, I forget who the guy the Cubs gave up for, I know the Cubs gave up for Ivan De Jesus, but there was another guy that came from the Phillies. Anyway, so I was at spring training when these guys all pulled in. And, you know, these guys were aging. Sarge only had a few years left. But Sarge was a serious team leader. I never saw anything like this in professional sports and never have since. The bus must have pulled up with those guys from the airport. They went and got their Cub uniforms on. And if you've ever seen spring training, you know, there's a bunch of guys hitting, a bunch of guys fielding. It's a big, before the game starts, it's a big mess of people out there all doing, it's like a big choreography. So they walk out, and Sarge walks out in the middle of the field. Tells everybody stop what they're doing, gather around. It's everybody around and says, "I am, you know, we're Sarge Matthews. This is Larry Boa. I'm looking around. Looks to me like we got a ball team." And all of a sudden, they took off right from there, Kevin. And Sarge was an amazing leader in the clubhouse. Just saying.
That's why they called him Sarge.
Yeah, well, that's kind of the end of my story. Jimmy, where do you remember Sandberg from?
I remember him as, you know, when we had just moved here, because that would be about the right time, from New Jersey. We went to go see him. He was just the guy that you always saw every day, and he'd be in the box scores. I did meet him once, surprisingly enough, at the Nike store on Michigan Avenue. Got in the elevator, and I realized, I said, "Hi, Mr. Sandberg." He's like, "No, just call me Ryan." This is after he stopped playing, but he was the type of guy that, you know, was very interesting. And I said, "Have a nice day." He goes, "Yes, I have to shop." Got off the elevator. I had been with other people, and I will not mention who because they are still on the air. The first thing that they go to, I don't do autographs. It's not like I even asked the man for an autograph. This is someone who is still on the air in sports in Chicago, who I'd run into more than once. Ryan Sandberg was the kind of guy that you felt like you probably could have a beer with.
Oh, yeah.
He was so unpretentious, it was amazing.
Well, Kevin, he was never really comfortable.
That is his reputation. There are many stories out in the world of just really nice encounters with the man. Like you said, unpretentious is a really good word for it. You know, very nice guy. He had a reputation as a clubhouse prankster. Specialized in the hot foot, which is something you don't see anymore. But then when you start looking at his career, my goodness, what did he have? Like 9 gold gloves, yep. 7 silver sluggers, perennial all-star. When he retired, he had the record for home runs by a second baseman. I think Jeff Kent passed him eventually, but he had the record for home runs by a second baseman. He would go almost entire seasons without having an error. Just a really, really outstanding ball player and an outstanding athlete. And he was one of those no wasted motion guys. You know, you see a lot of really great athletes where you just, you know, it's jaw dropping when you watch them. And a lot of Sandberg stuff was not so much jaw dropping as oh my God, he's there. He's in the right place, right time. Everything's nice and smooth, and that could be good. Of course, his most famous moment is referred to as the Sandberg game. It was a national TV game where he took Bruce Sutter deep. I mean, Bruce Sutter for the Cardinals at that time was still the unhittable relief pitcher who had a split finger pitch that just dropped off the table, and Sandberg took him deep in the ninth to tie the game, and then I think he came right back in the tenth and took him deep to win the game.
That's when I was that, it, who was Woody Herzog said who was that Baby Ruth or Baby Martin. What do they call him? Oh, Sandberg, is he like the Baby Ruth? What is he? Was his comment after the game?
Yeah, but that was, you know, that was when he became part of the national consciousness. So, you know, so that was a really, you know, like his big breakout where everybody saw how good he was.
But he was one of these guys that won every year.
Came up as a rookie, and he started, and he must have gone like over 30 or something.
One for 30.
Yeah, one for 30. So, you know, he came up. It was terrible slump. They started him at third base. Right off the bat, and I can't remember who they had at second base at the time, but you know, that was just part of, they knew eventually he would be moving, but to the middle infield, but they started him out at third base, and they just stuck with him, and eventually he emerged. Let me see what he, I got Baseball Reference up in here.
But he was not really a power hitter. He always had power, but Jim Frey's the one that says, you know, if you look at the spot. You always talk about it, Kevin. How you, if you have a count where you can look for that inside fastball, you can pull that ball. And early on, Steve Stone said, I remember him saying, the inside fastball was going to put Ryne Sandberg in the Hall of Fame, and it did, didn't it? Steve was pretty.
Yeah, sure did.
Yeah, and, but anyway, he always, when you talk about these contracts today, he always got the piggy move up contract with the Cubs. When he had a year left, he'd sign another couple years, cut another couple years. And when he finally became a free agent, I think he was very uncomfortable with it. And he ended up making all his money, and he had sort of a down year. And he didn't think he was worth what he was getting paid, so he retired. Isn't that the story, Kevin and Jimmy? And then he came back after, was it 1 or 2 years off? When he played for less. He was never happy being the highest paid guy on the team when he didn't have the best year of everybody.
Yeah, he played 57 games in 94. He did not play in 95, and then in 96 he came back, played 150 games.
How many people play 150 games now? Not too many.
Not too many. So he played two more full seasons after returning. He, you know, it also, you know, as you start to look, you go back to that first year, how many guys can do a 1-for-30 slump and, as rookies and come back and hit 271 for the season? You know, he started out slow. He had, you know, 7 home runs, 8 home runs, then 19, 26, 14, 16, 19, then 30, 40, 26, 26. So, you know, and then when he came back after sitting out a season, another 25 home runs. So, you know, he found his power numbers later. He was before the steroids era and never looked like a guy who would have been taking steroids anyway, although there were certainly baseball players during the steroids era who didn't take them and bulk up like Barry Bonds or Sammy Sosa did, but they still, you know, they still were taking them. So you see those. I don't think anybody would have suspected Ryne Sandberg of that in a million years. He is, if you look at him, I think he's one of like 4 players to ever have, not in the same year necessarily, but 40 home runs and 50 stolen bases at some point in his career. So, you know, just a really, really good ball player. It's a real treat to watch through his whole career.
You know, it's interesting, Kevin, I was kind of privy to, well, back when we were on the trading floor, and, you know, Dr. J was, he played college football, and he had a training camp thing with the Bears. He never was on a Bears roster, but he played a couple exhibition games. His brother Pete played 5 years. He also played in that, why do I always forget the name of this, Jimmy, the second other football league. It wasn't the
USFL?
Yeah, which was the first? The first one was the WFL. That was way back in the 70s, right? Then there was the USFL. I think it was USFL. So that's where they got Tom Thayer from, right? Kevin, is the Arizona Wranglers and the Sacramento somebody's. That was it. They didn't have a Chicago team the second time. The first time they did. Anyway, so, you know, Pete would regale me about all the steroid stories. And he would say stuff like, well, don't think for a second that it's always just a big fat lineman trying to be fatter. You know, he's just making fun of linemen. He says a lot of times it's your safety who's normally 190 that wants to play at 210. And he goes, and it's also a lot about, everybody thinks about it's bulking up, But you'd say, why would a guy like Ryan Sandberg take steroids? And I don't think he did. Matter of fact, I'd almost bet my life on it. But Pete says it's not about that. It's about injury recovery as well. He says, if all of a sudden you get banged up on a Sunday and you got a Thanksgiving Day game, a lot of guys will pop some that week. Not the idea that they're going to be 20 pounds heavier. A lot of it's in recovery. So some of the smaller guys are the ones that are taking them for those reasons and not the reasons where they want to be 280 instead of 210. I don't know. I'm sure you guys have heard some of that, but is that pretty much true, you think?
Yeah, I think that is absolutely true. It is all about recovery, and you know, it's your garden variety recovery. I remember from high school how sore I could be for a couple of days after a high school football game, and I can only imagine what it's like in the NFL. Is as brutal as that game is, I would think the faster recovery would be a huge deal.
Well, Keith Van Horn used to say, "Well, Monday was an exercise in getting out of bed."
Yeah. Yeah, and please don't poke me in the shoulders.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a... Hey, speaking of which, talk about segueing into something that's a horrible situation. This guy...
And I still want to get back to Ichiro, too, so let's not forget that. Go ahead.
Well, let's... Give me a second on this other topic, and then get back to not only Ichiro, but Richie Allen and Dave Parker. But this guy who shot up in New York yesterday or the day before, Jimmy, you were telling me about it. Turns out the dude was aiming for the NFL people?
Yes.
Supposedly, yeah.
And, go ahead, Jimmy. Jimmy, so what's the rest of that story, dude?
They, supposedly, he's made threats against, when they found him, that he had made threats against the NFL. What exactly, they didn't say, but this guy had a beef with the NFL.
He had a DET or whatever?
CTE.
Yeah, he had that, didn't he?
Yeah. Well, there's no way of knowing until he's dead and they cut him open. But he was claiming he had CTE, and it was somehow because of the NFL, even though he was a high school football player who never played in the NFL. So, I don't know that connection, and it's bizarre. But as Jimmy said, his beef was with the NFL apparently, and I'm going to have to see a lot more about see that thought process developed a little bit more before I truly understand it.
Well, what and we've beaten Epstein up to beat the band, but we have some people on the show that I think kiddingly will say something like, someday we got to go after these people and so forth. A lot of what we're seeing on several different subjects, guys, and this isn't right or left, it's Americans are getting a feel, especially as the economy is maybe doing the best for them, that somehow an awful lot of people seem to walk. The bigger you are, stuff gets ignored, you can walk and do stuff. I wonder on this CTE stuff. I mean, for a while when he was on the floor, I would have considered him a friend. After that, I didn't see him too much. Doug Buffon at CTE and had been a miserable last few years of his life. Our guy from Notre Dame, Kevin Dave Dorson, one of the guys on the training floor. I'll just say Nick, who I knew real well. I knew one of his older brothers. It was a big family. I didn't realize there was a brother that played football. He either played at Rice or Evergreen Park, and then he went on and played at Penn. So it wasn't like he was in a football factory or any place, but he played college ball, never played pro. All of a sudden, he's getting really wacky in his 30s or early 40s, blows himself away. And then the family, I don't know why, decided to, what do you send the brain to Boston, Kevin? Is that how disgusting what you got to do? Something like that?
There's a place that does research on that. Yep.
So sure enough, they come back with the conclusion the guy had the CTE. And I'd say that, you know, nothing is more powerful in this country right now, other than maybe the people who set the people up with Epstein, than the NFL. And they have absolutely walked away from this one. And all the people that are playing fantasy football and fans, nobody gives a crap, except if it's your family member. And I don't see them having a come-to-Jesus moment. There's been some work on the helmets. There's been some stuff and less whacking people in practice, and some school districts now don't let people tackle till they're 14. There's been some movement, but still, I don't think the the thing has been addressed. Certainly not enough to the point where if it was your family member, nobody on the show ever advocates violence, but somehow, Kevin, stuff like this happening, especially when it's a brain debilitating disease, I guess I'm not all that shocked. Are you? Are you, Jimmy?
No. I mean, Kevin had brought up, back when I played, he played, college, high school football. You have to realize now in high school football, especially down in some of the bigger states like Texas, there are kids that already weigh 300 pounds.
Yeah.
On the offensive line. That's got to start to cause those collisions that they're having now have to be almost as hard as they are in college. These kids are getting huge.
Yeah, remember when William Perry got drafted by the Bears and he was a freak because he was 300 pounds?
Yeah.
Yeah, now it's average.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a... Well, plus I think artificial surface, you go faster, right? Pretty much?
Yeah, and it's got to hurt on the knees, and especially with these kids now, these offensive linemen at 300. Who knows what they are putting on their hips, their joint, on the knees, the joints. You're not supposed to be that big at when you're 16, 17 years old.
Yeah, I mean, you can grow the muscles. You can add, fat to that extent so that you have bulk. That's not helping your joints, though. Your joints are what they are, and they aren't made to take that kind of abuse.
Well, my buddy Mark Duffy, who played for Bo up in Michigan, said, and Bo is one of those guys, and I don't think there are any coaches like this anymore, Kevin. He wanted everybody to be able to run, like even the linemen. So the only guy on the team he allowed to be over 240 or 245 was Dan Dierdorf, who was just a huge man. So Dan was like 250, and my buddy Duffy said, there wasn't an ounce of fat on the guy. And what would Dierdorf be today? 350? 3 1/4? Because now they don't seem to care if you got a big tub of lard around your gut. Even if you're 18 years old or 19, it's just a different world. It's almost like sumo wrestling. You have to be quick in an area. I mean, I can't imagine half of these offensive linemen in college running 100. Can you? Well, they probably could, but they wouldn't want to. Anyway, Kevin, back to the other people in the Hall of Fame. Ichiro is about as elite as it gets. He's one of only four players in the history of baseball. And it's even that everything you say has a clause to it. When did the Gold Gloves start? 52, 53? So there was none of those before that. They just knew people that were good fielders. But he's one of four people that have 10 Gold Gloves and a lifetime batting average over 300. That's about as sacred a group as you can find. Can you name the other three?
Gold Gloves and a lifetime batting average over 300. 10 Gold Gloves, you say?
Yeah.
I don't even think I can hazard a guess.
Well, I got two. When the first way through, Willie Mays, and he hung in there long enough that his lifetime batting average was like 301. If he'd have played any longer, he might have ducked under 3. Roberto Clemente, part of that may because he died young. I'm not, but what's his name? The guy from Baltimore, second baseman. No, the second baseman. Oh.
Second baseman from Baltimore.
Mm. His brother caught for the Cubs. Roberto Alomar.
Oh, okay.
And then it was, of all people, Pudge Rodriguez, and he stayed and he dropped down to like 299, 298, and Ichiro moved into the group. The guys that are closest are Keith Hernandez is like 290 something, and he's got 10 Gold Gloves. I think Al Kaline's in that group. He's like 290 something. There's a few people that are close, but that's a tough deal. But hit 300 over like a 20-year career or something, or 15-year career, is pretty friggin' awesome, isn't it? Not to mention how many people even have 10 Gold Gloves. It's a small group, and you got a lot of guys. There's people like Mark Grace has 7, Seinberg had 9. Because usually when you come in, there's kind of a guy at your position that like always wins.
Evaluating Gold Gloves, it's a very subjective award, and there are many, many years when somebody, a lot of people will say, yeah, he's good, but I don't think he should have won it. You know, but you can always look at it this way. If you're in the top two or three year after year after year, you're damn good.
Yeah. Well, to start this off, maybe we already did start it off, but Richie Allen was in this group, and his wife gave the, because he's dead. Dave Parker recently died, but somebody was doing a thing on TV, and I forgot the source, Kevin. You or Jimmy, maybe you can find it. I don't know if it was a certain, if they took like the best 10 years of somebody's career, and they had him up against Willie Mays, Roberto Clemente, and like four other, and he was right there, right in the middle. He was ahead of a few of them. And the idea was not that he was better than those guys or anything like that, because he wasn't defensively. But they said, why is it every other guy on this list was a first ballot Hall of Famer, and he's in, what, 25 years after he retired from the Veterans Committee? Because you would think, what was Dave Parker, I would have thought during his playing years, you know, he would have got in. I'm not saying first ballot or whatever. What did they get in the first ballot, like 20% or something?
Well, there were a couple of things at play with them, with both of those guys. So in Allen's case, he just had a very, very bad relationship with media in general. So the people who were voting on him, they had you talk about love-hate relationships, that was pretty much just a hate-hate relationship. And Allen, you know, he could be difficult. He played for a lot of teams, especially in the last half of his career, for a reason, because, you know, he'd wear out his welcome. So I think a lot of people held that against him, even though you're right, through the middle of his career, he was as good as it gets. Dick Allen hit the hardest ball I have ever seen in person.
Well, God, did he have the pipes or what?
Well, I was in the right near the front of the left field. I think it was grandstands in Comiskey Park, and this was 1972, his MVP year, and he hit this line drive, and I said, "Oh, that has a chance to get here. You know, it's low. It might not clear the fence, but it has a chance to get to me. You know, it was right at me." And I was maybe first or second row of the stands there, and not a very crowded day, an afternoon game. And this ball just kept going up and up and up. It was on a line. It didn't have much arc to it, but it was on a line. Just kept it wound up in the upper deck. But my first reaction when I saw it is, oh, that's a liner. That has a chance to get here. You know, might not, might hit the wall, but has a chance to get here. Damn, it just kept going.
Were you going to make a move for it, or did you duck?
Oh, no, I would absolutely make a move for it.
There you go.
Yeah, I would try and catch it. And, no doubt about that. So, that's one of my memories of him. But, just an incredible ball player. When you talk about Parker, his issues... first of all, he had a lot of injuries at the end of his career, so he kind of tapered off towards the end, and so that didn't leave it fresh. But if you remember, there was a whole lot of cocaine scandal, and a lot of it centered around the Pirates. Dale Barrow was notably caught up in it, and a number of other players at the time. And this was sort of after Pops was gone,
Pops, meaning Willie Stargell.
Willie Stargell, yeah, and. So, you know, there was just a lot of that, and I think a lot of that was held against him, too, when it came to the votes. So, and you see that. It's just like, you know, we see the same thing with a lot of the steroids guys now, at that time, drug use like that was a taboo.
Well, there also was a really overhead of, first of all, baseballs in general... Baseball players in general were not supposed to speak out. They had no power with the teams. They long before any kind of collective bargaining agreement, and they were there for other people's pleasure, basically. All right. I mean, they were supposed to treat it as a sport. Because by the way, we'd all love to be a Major League Baseball player, right? And yet the owners got to treat it like a business, even though that was your livelihood. It was kind of an odd world. I mean, Jimmy's a little younger than us, I'd say it went five times worse if you were black. Is that a fair statement?
Well, that was sort of the label on Allen. You know, Parker wasn't that, but no. Allen had that angry black man, treatment, and how he was perceived. And yeah, it, you know, at the time that didn't go over well. I don't think anybody'd give a damn now, but at the time it just, you know, didn't play. And I think all that was held against him as well.
Well, one year,
I'm glad it's kind of, you know, that people have let that go and are just willing to look at what he did as a ball player, because he was.
Well, I'm glad that people have let it go on many levels, but the one thing he did that really frosted people, and I remember this because, God, it was my senior year, I think, Kevin, we went down to Florida. And it had to be, he was still on the Sox in 74, when it had to be spring of 74. So he was down in spring training, and of course somebody interviewed him. He had said something like, said, well, Mr. Allen, you came in a couple of days late. And he goes, the last thing I need is 6 weeks standing out in the sun. I don't need that. I'm ready to play, or something along those lines. And of course, he's excoriated. This big black guy doesn't want to show up for work. He's making all his money, blah, you know, the huge, the, everything.
Yeah, now we would have fun with it. We're talking about practice, not a game.
Yeah, and so just so happens, Billy Hake and a bunch of us were down there. We go to see the Yankees play Baltimore. And Baltimore's got this, and I should remember the name, and because he was a star for a long time, this big black guy playing left field. In Baltimore, Belanger is supposedly one of the best, second and short combo in like the history of baseball, or one of the top few. Well, they couldn't catch their ass with both hands that day. They must have made like five errors on double play balls. In the fourth inning, the score is 19-1. And they're getting their ass kicked, right? So this guy's standing out in left field, and it's hot. It's brutally hot, Florida, because it was down in Lauderdale. And all of a sudden he comes in, and we just got around a beer, and we were right next to the dugout. He walks up to Billy, and he goes, do you mind? And he grabs his beer and slugs it down. And the thing with Dickie Allen couldn't have been the day before. And I said, how you doing out there? He goes, I haven't even gotten a friggin' ball. I haven't batted yet, and I'm dying. He goes, I'll take care of you guys. And sure enough, 2 minutes later, a beer guy comes around and buys us all a beer. I'm sitting there going, and everybody's bitching a blue streak at Dickie Allen, and I'm thinking, how is this helping this guy's season, standing out there? It had to be 4.5 hours. We left him like the fifth inning, Kevin, who was already in the 20s on the runs. And he was still standing out there. He's like, what am I doing out there? I'm never going to even get a ball. Like, these guys are muffing it in the infield.
Well, there was a time, and look, there are teams that definitely need to work on their fundamentals and all that in spring training, but there was a time when ball players went to spring training to get into shape.
Yeah.
You know, now they train all year round. They might take a little time off to break it down a little bit, but by and large, you know, they report to spring training in shape, so they really don't need it in the same ways that they did before.
Well, the pitchers do, because you can only go every fourth day or whatever, and some of the hitters, if you're working on something different, but it's a way to see all your minor league players, see who can surprise. You know, a lot of time the major league managers don't get to see the minor league guys, then all of a sudden they do. But I mean, it's when you have those split squad games, I mean, those are all AAA guys, aren't they, most of them? I mean, early on. But when we used to go, it was, you know, it was nothing. But I remember Jim Fry, it's one hot day, and they said something about, they said, what do you think about like spring training baseball? And he goes, well, you got to do it. He says, but it's, he goes, look at all these people coming in here, and they're coming in here at 10 in the morning. It's hotter than hinges of hell. He goes, this is going to be bad baseball today, yet people want to see it. Jim Fry was pretty out front. But then I used to go, you wanted to go the last week, because then you saw everybody's starting rotation do their last for real start. So you actually saw real baseball the last week. Jimmy, you ever been to spring training?
Nope.
It's fun. It's a lot of fun. I mean, how could it get any worse? You get up in the morning, you work out, have some breakfast, go out and watch a ball game, take a nap, go to dinner. I mean, life is good, don't you think, Kevin?
It is. It can be.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's cheap, and there used to be like nobody there, but now the Cubs are crowded all the time. But some of the other people aren't. You just go see the other guys play. What's the difference? And but if you went the last week, what was the one year that they lost like every game? Was it 83 or 84? And I went the last week, and all of a sudden they had just gotten Steve Trout. They mowed everybody down in the last four games. My mother goes, what are you watching that crummy team for? I said, ma'am, I don't think they're that bad. And they weren't. I mean, all of a sudden, they came together. That was a terrific trade, too, getting Steve Trout. And they got Eckersley. Of course, Eckersley kind of drank his way out of Chicago, didn't he? But anyway, what The Ichiro was. I didn't even get to see him speak. Can he talk enough, or do you have to have an interpreter?
Yeah, he was pretty funny, because he was left off of one ballot, and so one of the quips he made in his speech was to that one person who I invited I forget exactly how he worded it, but to the one guy I invited to come to my house for dinner, the invitation is no longer any good.
God.
And you know, he did it with a smile on his face. But yeah, I saw a little bit of his speech. He did a nice job. The thing about Ichiro, what was he, like 27, 28 when he came to the U.S. to play?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's, you know, most guys who get 3,000 hits are either at or approaching 1,000 by that age. And of course, he was at zero and still wound up with over 3,000 hits. So, you know, just an incredible hitter, you know, incredible throwing arm in the outfield, outstanding outfielder. We talked about all his gold gloves. There is just nothing not to like about Ichiro's game. He didn't hit for a ton of power. In fact, you know, his home run total for 19 years was 117. But he could have, you know, and if that's what his team needed was a power hitter, he probably could have been, and was well known for having batting practice home run derbies with some of the other players on the Mariners. And they had some really good players over those years. So, just a really, really treat to watch on those rare occasions when we get to see him, because we didn't get a lot of TV time with West Coast teams here in the Midwest, especially me in the Eastern time zone. But he would come to town once in a while, and it was pretty cool to get the opportunity to see him play.
Well, they didn't play cross games in those days, but I'm gonna say I never saw the guy play, and it was before Fox and before ESPN had their game of the weeks too, right? I never saw him play, and I don't think I've ever seen Mike Trout play, which is pretty awful when you think about it. Cause I like baseball, and even back in the day when I used to go to games. I mean, if you were to ask me, you know, I was 12, 15 years old, coming from the South Side. Seems like every time that I went to see a game, it was the Pirates. So if you ask me who's the best position player you ever saw, I would easily say Roberto Clemente. I wouldn't say he was the best of everybody, but every time I was there, the guy did something like nobody else could do. But I never saw the Giants play. And then when we got the 305 games, and I don't know if they did this on purpose, guys, but every game seemingly was the Phillies. So I saw Carlton pitch probably six times. I never saw anybody better than him. Now, was he better than Gibson, better than Koufax? Well, I don't know, but I never saw those guys. But if you ask me who's the best pitcher you ever saw, it would be easy. Carlton and Greg Maddux. Maybe Fergie. But Carlton was in class by himself.
And Fergie would be up there. I saw Fergie pitch a lot. I saw Gibson pitch a few times.
So I never had the pleasure for that. I saw him on TV, but... real quick, we don't want to go... Well, we don't have much time anyway, but I want both of your guys' opinion... As we're unwrapping, and somehow the politics has gotten involved in this Epstein situation, but I actually think it's the first time the right and the left have been in agreement on something as long as I can remember. But how far down the onion are we going to go? I mean, we talked on the show a bunch, not so much with you, Kevin, because we've got other stuff to talk about, but how far down the onion are we going to go? I mean, there's the idea that it's just plain sleazy. The idea that let's get the guys who went after the young girls. Then there's the what about the money? Then there's what about if there's, security things in the middle, like Israeli security, Russian, CIA. And then the point is, if these people were being set up by somebody, who the hell is the somebody? And who are they? I mean, I can go up to like six levels on this. Jimmy, you're afraid... I don't know that you can disagree with that part so much of all the different levels, but how far can we go? Who the hell can go? Who can even do the investigation? Who's either agency or people they know are involved? How do you even go with this? Jimmy, you go first, then Kevin.
I have no idea how you begin, because you're right. You have a ton of issues on this. like they said, you know, Miss Maxwell, well, her father was Robert Maxwell, you know, British publisher, this or that. Now,
could have been one of the biggest crooks ever, right?
Correct. And they started to figure out this guy probably did have contacts in the Maasai and over in Russia, this or that. And who knows that she hasn't been approached by these people prior. And with Epstein, we probably do know who went to the island, and I think the reason you do have an agreement on both sides, because both sides are just as guilty, to be honest with you. But who do you get to be impartial? I have no idea.
Boy, if you had to pick, who would that be, Kevin? Where's the Dan Inouye when we need him this time?
Well, I don't know about the impartial, but as much as I would like people who abused underage girls to be exposed and punished, I would also like to know if this was all about compromising people. Who was compromised, and how did that show up? So, you know, when we say, Senator Schmatz was compromised, that and so he was left to do their bidding. How did that work out? Sort of like the Nevada senator in The Godfather. He at the beginning he didn't like the Italians. He didn't like the Corleone family. But once they had him compromised at their brothel, then how much of their bidding did they get him to do? I would like to know that, and I would like to know who on whose behalf that was done.
Well, Kevin, have you listened to any of this stuff? I don't know how she got her information. This lady, Whitney Webb?
Well, I haven't listened to her, but, you know, you've described her a lot. This is just someone who's out there digging. And that's one of the problems that we have with journalism today is they, you know, too many of the alleged journalists they have their sources. Their sources feed them information, and they just repeat it uncritically. They don't dig in and verify for themselves. They don't follow the stories, and that's how we've gotten so many of the things, that we've seen in recent years. You can pick out any story that you want. All it takes is a little bit of critical thinking, a little bit of digging to say, no, that can't possibly be true, or that doesn't, it doesn't sound right. Just start with that. That doesn't seem plausible. And yet, you know, we see a lot of reporting that just says, okay, I'll repeat that, no problem. Okay, cool, you did that. What we see as news is that. So you just have a source there who is just saying, I'm going to dig into this. I'm not going to take what anybody says. I'm going to just dig into it for myself and follow the trails where they are, because the trails do exist.
Well, it is. Some of the stuff, I mean, Kevin, you would do the same thing, and so does Jimmy. You can listen to one of these podcasts or whatever. There's a news article, and even if the person, you might totally agree or think there's a total knucklehead, if there's a, they might come across a fact or two or say something that rings a bell. I mean, nobody can be, even the dumbest man on earth knows something you don't know, right? I mean, I honestly believe that. But she came out with a couple things where the lady asked her, why do you have two books now, 1,000 pages on this? And she goes, well, I'll tell you why. Because all of a sudden I'll get a tip about some bank or some place where the money was going through. And I'll do some research on the bank, and all of a sudden the bank becomes a whole chapter. Because the bank may go back to Iran-Contra, may go back to World War II doing the same stuff. She goes, the amazing part is when you go back on this stuff, it's the same people, the same group of... She blames it all, Kevin, on during World War II, there were... Everything had to happen so fast, and no matter how... what was the guy's name? The OSS guy was Bill something, Big Bill. And the British Secret Service was Bill Stevenson, who I've read quite a bit about. They were super honest guys, but they also, evidently, they got in bed with the mob in certain areas for production, for longshoremen's unions, for things like that. And even though these guys are no longer, and they might have been purer than Pharaoh's wife, her point is this constant interaction between the underworld and the intelligence communities has pretty much stayed in place. And she goes, it's bizarre when you go back. It's not just Epstein and the people setting these people up. And she goes, it's the people who had the wherewithal to set this up to compromise other people, just like you're talking about, Kevin. Because those are the people, not only would you like to find, but you'd also, they go back at least to Iran-Contra. It's the same banks, the same, you know, intelligence agencies, the same crap. And I don't know how it's sort of the same thing we've talked on the show how many times about, okay, Michael Madigan gets sentenced, somebody in Commonwealth Edison gets sentenced. I want that rate increase back, is what you just said, right, Kevin, even though you didn't say it. What do they do? If they got a rate increase, I don't want to pay it. Why should I? Right?
Well, yeah, I'm with you on that. And, you know, it is nice that we do have people out there working independently. And I think we're starting to sway that way a little bit. I think that the last election, you know, I know I tried to get you to, you know, get some Trump and Vance, and, you know, you can even find other people who are interesting, you know, whether it's Bernie Sanders or Tulsi Gabbard or any of these people.
You think Trump would have come on a show?
Well, I don't know if he'd come on this show, but he sat down. You know, my goodness, if you look at just the number of people who listen to him sit down for 2 hours or 3 hours and talk to people, that you get a totally different perspective on him and on policies. And that's why you get people who say, well, here's what he's trying to accomplish, because he laid it out on there. And so it's just a matter of how good are these podcast people, you know, how good are they at asking questions? I mean, and that's what you're seeing with the woman who's looking into Epstein. She's good at asking questions. Because, you know, now, I mean, 3 hours with Joe Rogan is a very, you know, wide-ranging interview with a whole lot of follow-up questions and a whole lot of pressing, tell me more about this and I want to know more about that. And, you know, you get before the election and you say 57 million people watched it before the election. And that's in addition to the 1 to 2 million that listened to it live. So when a lot of people say, well, did you really know what you were voting for? Yeah, 57 million people knew exactly what that was going to be about. You know, Andrew Schultz's podcast was a little bit different. He had 14 million views the first week, and you know, but you know, that was a very popular amongst young people. You know, you get all these people with millions and millions of listeners, and they're long form. That's the big deal. You're not getting anything that is a sound bite. You're not getting this 5 minutes of interview or they sit down with an interview and then they edit it down to 15 or 20 minutes even, and they edit out a lot of stuff. This is just open and raw, and I think that's because that was so effective in the last election, that you're going to see more and more and more of this. And that's a good thing, because we are not being served by, you know, the mainstream media creatures that we are all used to watching.
Well, and
there's better sources. There's really good sources out there.
I listened to a dude yesterday, and everybody, I think, somewhat has a skill set. And this guy, Kevin, you would have branded him a wacko right out of the gate. And probably Jimmy would, too, but I listened to him, and it turns out that the guy claims to be a former Army interrogator, whatever the hell that means. And he said he's interrogated, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people. I don't know where he was in Afghanistan or where he was. But the interview with Trump, where asking him, where he said he didn't have the privilege. He was invited to the island, but he didn't take up the privilege, or whatever the hell he said. This guy goes through the entire interview, Kevin. Now, again, line by line, and says, here he's, and some of the stuff was pretty interesting. Or Trump said something, and then he kind of embellished it, and he kept embellishing it, which is his style. Okay, I get that. He goes, all right, that's a lie. And he goes, here's why. He says, if Kevin's home late and the wife asks him where he was, if he didn't do anything wrong, he said, I had to stop the store. End of story. If you did, you'll say, I had to stop the store, I had to buy shaving cream, I had to buy this, and you go through this whole list of crap that's totally unnecessary because you're covering something up. The interesting part about Trump is he's so bad at it. It's one man's opinion. And it doesn't make any difference on the politics or whatever. But he said, is there a list? And Trump said something to the effect of, no, there isn't a list, but there might have been 11 people. The guy would stop right there. If he knew there was 11 people, he saw the list. He's like, don't say there's 11 people on a list you never saw. But, you know, again, he obviously has his agenda and stuff. But it was pretty interesting how somebody who's somewhat trained can sort of take apart something somebody says. Not, you know, whether he's right or wrong. The guy seemed like kind of a nut job. But some of the stuff he was saying, like I said, even the people that are nut jobs, somehow you can get a little bit of a... He goes, Trump said four times that there was no list, yet he told you four different times what was on it.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's good because you just don't get those people very much. If you watch ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox News, and, you know, CNN, et cetera, if you watch those, you don't. You just get regurgitation of what people told you without any critical pursuits. And that's why I think that, you know, that we're entering a different era of how we cover news, and it's gaining a lot of traction. It's not, you know, there's a whole lot of people that are oblivious to it still, but you are finding especially a younger generation of people who are very podcast oriented, and they listen to a lot of this stuff.
Well, you have to listen to a bunch of different people and draw the facts out of all.
I think so, and I think also the longer form the interview is, the better.
You and I have been doing this for a long time, Kevin.
Want to throw out BS in a 5 or 10 minute interview, you probably get away with it. If you want to throw out BS over several hours with somebody who's really good at asking follow up questions, you're not going to get away with it. They're going to pin you down.
Well, you do wonder. I mean, on the other side, I had dinner with Dr. J the other night, and it was fun. But he's the one who told me when to be a guest on CNBC. I mean, first of all, CNBC is the low hanging fruit because they want if the profits of O'Neill Inc. come out on a Tuesday morning, they want to be the first to interview Kevin O'Neill. So Kevin O'Neill is going to say, you're not asking me this, you're not asking me that, I'm never coming back. So you see this 5 or 6 softball questions because they really want you there more than they really want to ask you a question. You know, stuff like, by the way, did you really think about the guys you laid off? So you're not going to get that kind of question. Did you know any of those people? You're not going to get that, right? So, and if you do, they're never going to
get those. You will get those in the long form interviews.
Yeah, it depends on how much. There's only so much, because I'm sure they have the right to not publish it. I mean, is this done in advance or is it live?
We do it live.
Okay, but I'm saying there's going to be some point at which the person gets up and why. But there's going to be stuff that they're not going to answer, no matter who it is. You and I would be the same way, right? I mean, that's just the way it is. And you're hoping, and the interviewer has to be good enough to touch on stuff to get his answers without making it so obvious he's delving where you don't want to go. Because you can't do that. You're not going to get a seasoned politician to give you the answer that you really want if he's hiding something. Nobody's going to do that.
Well, and just I'll give you a different example, but a very, very simple example, because I still run into Tim Priester, who's been covering Notre Dame athletics as long as I can remember, since he got out of college. And he still says to me, you were so good at asking questions in press conferences. Look, a lot of it is in how you ask the question. So in my case, if you wanted to know why some young basketball player who it looks like can help you is not playing, and I know my reader base thought that Mike Bray was being a dumbass for not playing him. I knew I was never going to get an answer when I said, You know, Mike, why isn't Martin Gavin playing more? Or why isn't Ricky Cornett playing more? I was never going to get an answer out of that. He was going to, you know, he'd like get some platitudes. But if I asked Mike some questions about how, you know, how in general does a guy crack the rotation on your teams? A guy who hasn't been playing, how do they, you know, what is it that triggers you to play a guy more, and dig into that and ask him some follow-ups in that same forum, I'm going to get long answers. And I'm going to get long answers because people do like to talk shop. They do like to talk about themselves. I once had a conversation with a bartender. I use this sometimes in class when I talk about...
I'm the guy who's never been in a bar of a conversation with a bartender.
Yeah, I know. It's hard to believe. But actually, there was a situation, and this goes back several years now, when I had some business in Chicago early in the day, and then I was going to get together with my family for dinner. And so I had time to kill in the afternoon, and I went into this tavern to get some lunch, have a beer. You know, as I recall, the early rounds of Wimbledon were on, and, you know, and there was hardly anybody in there because it was like 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a work day. So, you know, I'm sitting there shooting the breeze with the bartender, and I said, you know, you make a living based on, you know, on tips, and your tips are going to depend a lot on, you know, how well you have conversations with people. So I said, what is it that you do to have successful conversations and have lengthy conversations? And she said to me, well, two things. She says, there's two things here. One is I ask people about themselves, because people love to talk about themselves. You know, it's real easy. So how you frame a question, and this goes back to, you know, what I did with Mike Braze, I'm asking him to talk shop, basically. I'm asking him to tell me how he goes about, you know, making decisions and what his processes are like and that kind of thing. So I ask him about themselves. The second thing he says is I ask open-ended questions. I never ask anybody a yes or no question. And then I let them talk, you know, people are interesting, so, you know, I definitely take an interest in them. So I said to her, well, let me give you one more then, that you can do that always works really well for you too, and that's during a conversation, see if you can find a way to pay somebody a sincere compliment. You know, because that's the Maya Angelou expression, long after people remember what you discussed. Well,
the group I hang around with at the bar, that would be a real challenge.
Remember how you made them feel. You know, and so in a business setting, while that's a smoking hot dress you're wearing is not an appropriate compliment, but to be able to look at somebody after you're having a conversation, like at a business networking event, and say, you know, it is really cool to see somebody who really, really seems to enjoy your work so much and is so committed to what you do. I think that's the kind of compliment I'm talking about.
So you can't say and looks hot on top of it.
You leave that alone in a business setting. Okay. But you know, my point is that you know find ways. You know, sincere. Don't ever be insincere. But if you have an opportunity to say something really nice to somebody, do it. Because that's part of engagement as well, and that's how people will remember that. And so whether you're sitting down for a 2-hour interview and you get that compliment in the first 15 minutes, or whether it's an add-on conversation that you have down the road, it's going to help you continue to get get genuinely good information from people, and that's worth it.
I agree. Well, Kevin, we got a day. I'm sure we have Russell. It's after 7.
Yeah, Russell's on. What time is it? My God,
we've been pontificating. How long could we talk about baseball forever? Russell, you're with us, bud. How are you?
I'm with you. I listened intently. What I find so funny is I'm actually now allowed to share the big news that I shared with you, and maybe we'll get some insight into all of this. One of our guest contributors is going to be working the next school year for NBC at the White House.
One of our guests are typically couldn't be anybody you
my
know.
My daughter.
Yes, couldn't be anybody you know. Yes. Well,
yeah.
that should be fun.
She scored an internship. She said she's going to find out what she can tell us and what she can't. But in a year, she's going to have some great insights about what you guys were just talking about.
Well, that'll be cool. Hey,
yeah.
I have a question for you. I was on, being Mr. Professor, I was on a, Joan Esposito does a show on in the afternoon, and once in a while they invite me on, and I'm kind of the, you know, the guy who supposedly knows business and the markets and everything. But I tell you what, all three of you dudes, it is so hard for me to do a guest appearance because I don't know my crowd and I don't know what the hell level.
Oh.
I don't know what. So I kick it on an hour early, and she's got a lady on there, and they're talking about inflation. And the lady must do a lot of research on inflation, and she was talking about last week, you know, something was down, something's up, and this is where you see it, and they're trying to figure out if tariffs have made an intrusion yet, and so they're talking about tomatoes because most of those are imported, and I'm sitting there, so all of a sudden it's my turn, and I'm going, okay, now how exactly do I zip into this thing? So first thing she says something about, well, the Fed's meeting tomorrow. Why should anything the Fed do, like, affect me? I'm sitting there going, okay, where do I start?
Oh, boy.
Where do I start with that one? And I go, well, Joan, to be perfectly honest, everything the Fed does affects you. And she's like, well, why? And I said, because they're the ones, all that you've been talking about, inflation. I said, let me start for where I probably shouldn't start. Nobel Prize winner once said, all inflation is always a monetary phenomenon. And she says, what does that mean? And I'm thinking, now I'm circling the red hole right out of the gate, right? I'm going, well, it all has to do with the amount of money in the system. And if there's too much money chasing too few goods, everything goes up. And you can analyze, like, individual products going up and down. But the general price level is always a monetary phenomenon, and that's pretty much controlled by the Fed or whoever's, you know, pressuring those people. I said, so if there's too much money coming in, that's, you're going to see inflation. It may be in chicken this week or pork next week, but it's going to get there somehow because the money's in the system. And the fact that individual items go up and down is a tribute to essentially the free market system. But I said during COVID, I mean, you saw it and your listeners all saw, you know, a dramatic increase in prices all over the block. I said, in fact, I'm sure you remember, we were damn near in a depression. I mean, nobody was working, yet prices were going up. That's because the Fed, in an 18-month period, poured 40% more money in the system. She goes, how could they do that? And I said, well, you buy bonds from people, you put bonds into the system, and the Fed essentially, I said, I don't want to go there on their balance sheet. I said, but basically, they buy stuff, mortgages and bonds, and they pay for it with essentially new money. She goes, is that the same as printing it? I said, well, it's technically credit, but the answer is yes. She goes, well, why would they do that? I said, well, because they wanted everybody to feel like everything was all right, and it spit out. So the inflation that you talk about a lot, everybody knows that the number's not 20%, it's more like 35 or 40. Because everybody on your show, because they have a sense of that, is right. And the numbers you're getting are not right. And she's like, well, how can that be? So I'm sitting there going, now I'm into a discussion that I'm not even sure I wanted to go on Stocks and Jacks, and everybody here is like traders and so forth. And I'm on this on a show that nobody has any idea what I'm talking about. But I also have people in our show that have called me up and said, I understand what you guys are talking about, but don't ever dumb it down. That's why I listen. But I don't know if on another station people feel that way. I mean, but I also got to answer the question. What else could I do? I'm there for a reason. So it's kind of an odd feeling. Just saying.
No, I mean, I got to adjust for audience all the time.
Well, it's hard to do when you don't know the audience.
Yeah, no, well, but and luckily as a college professor, you got a pretty good idea as to what your undergrads know and what your graduate students know and in different programs, et cetera. But then also, you know, depending on the program that I'm on, I talked to somebody from one of the networks that I used to be on fairly frequently, and I said, you know, why did I stop being asked back? And his there were two parts of the response. One was my personality was a little too goofy for their network, which I can understand that. And I mean, I'm self-aware enough to kind of get that. They want somebody. They're more interested in somebody that's very straight-laced and boring all the time, and doesn't try to slip any humor in there whatsoever. Which I get that part. totally get that part. But the other part was sometimes I was too technical and people couldn't fully follow what I was talking about. And this is on a business network. And you know, I would always get called in around VIX, which is a difficult topic. And, you know, I forget that everybody doesn't fully understand what it's really telling you and how it's formulated, et cetera. They just know it's referred to as a fear index. But there are times that, you know, I got to remember everybody doesn't, and like you too, everybody doesn't fully understand the markets the way that we do. On this program, there's no dumbing down in my mind. But, you know, you do got to adjust periodically. I don't really, what's Joan Esposito's, what's her program normally?
Well, it's total, it's all progressive. It's very progressive radio. As a matter of fact, I tried to get us on in the morning and they go, we don't want you anymore. And I go, what do you mean? I'd be paying. I said, no, you're way too moderate. You're
okay.
And then, by the way, a lot of the other people are level. The listeners don't even want anything from the right even said.
Okay. It's kind of the opposite of I know.
Yeah, it's the opposite.
I know 560 is very conservative.
Yeah, it's their alter ego, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. So,
but I don't know how you know.
I'll tell you, the only reason this is so obscure, it's ridiculous, and this is probably why they don't have me on the business networks. The reason I can remember 560 so well, that was the rock and roll station in Memphis that first started playing Elvis Presley.
Wow.
It was 560 AM. It was the first. That's how I can remember that radio station number.
Well, the 560
that's nothing
here,
to do with the politics.
The 560 here used to be, was it Howard Miller?
Or something like that, but yeah, it's yeah. It's like the conservative. It's the from my understanding, and I don't really listen to the local radio that much, but 560 is, if you put a spectrum out there, that they would be the most conservative.
Well, I told you a story about me and CNBC. I used to go on once in a while, and I didn't really like to.
Mm-hmm.
We had a bunch of traders at the time, and I was busy in the morning, and they'd want you to go. You had to go down to Black, get makeup on, you know, dress up. And of course, Audrey, significant other, always says to, I get in his room and they say, look into the camera. There was no camera. You just got to look at one end, and there was no monitor. So you couldn't even really tell who you were talking to.
You were just kind of, I know.
And so one day I'm on there to talk about Walmart earnings, which I could give a rat's ass about, right? And there's like five people, so they didn't need me. And all of a sudden, it was the morning that Warren Buffett bought the Burlington Northern.
Okay.
And so Joe Kernan says to me, say, Tom, what do you think of this merger? And I said, well, Joe, you kind of hit on a strong spot, because I've been a history in railroads. So the Burlington Northern is a combination of the Northern Pacific, the Great Northern, Chicago, Burlington, and Quincy, and there was another one. I said, they pretty much control the entire upper Midwest. Said for lack of a better term, it's somewhat of a monopoly in you know, 20 states. I said, and they just discovered oil up there. I mean, Warren Buffett has basically just bought a monopoly. He's no dummy, and they couldn't wait to get me off. And I've never been invited back. But I don't think it was
because
all that bad.
Because you used the phrase monopoly, or
yeah, well, this is not. Speaking of which, either one of you guys, what do you make of the? Was it the Union Pacific getting together with the Norfolk and Western? What is that all about?
I haven't looked at the overlap on that one, and what the if there's any economies of scale or anything
like
that.
Well, one is the eastern part of the country. We only have four railroads left.
Yeah, and there are only a couple of places in the middle of the country where they could link up, right?
There's
some massive spot in. You know, and this makes me sound like a terrible urban person. You know, in Nebraska, Oklahoma, somewhere like that, that they have the graduated rail that they split all the different cars going from west to east off, so they go in the right direction.
Well, they used to be all in Chicago, and it still is a pretty big one of that. But
But
I mean, you only have two railroads going west,
mm-hmm.
the Union Pacific and the Southern Pacific, right? And then you've got the Burlington Northern, which is north, and they bought the Santa Fe. So there's two going west.
Yeah.
There's only two going east. There's a Chessie system and a Norfolk and Southern system. Then you've got the Canadian National, which owns You know, some stuff in the Midwest, and they own the old IC, which goes down the middle.
Mm-hmm.
But one of those guys bought the Kansas City Southern, which was, so we're really talking about, now does that mean the Burlington has to get together with the Chessie system when we only have two friggin' railroads? What is the purpose?
It's very possible.
Why not just have one? What are we doing here?
Well, if you have one, then you know.
What?
This is going to sound, this is so anti me, and I don't mean this is the right thing, but if you only have one, you may as well nationalize it.
Well, yeah. I mean, what?
Yeah, because if you have one, if you just have one, much like, you know, and this isn't necessarily true, but years and years and years ago, you know, you had one power company that you had to deal with, and you called them up, they turned your lights on, you didn't pay the bill, you turned your lights off. You know, in Memphis, it was MLG&W, Memphis Light, Gas, and Water, which was very independent, which was kind of nice. You weren't really even dealing with a big public company or anything like that. But, you know, what they could charge, et cetera, was being dictated by, you know, the government, basically. You know, they're set their rates based on a government schedule. So if you if you nationalize the railroad, which probably wouldn't be the worst idea in the world in some countries, it'd be a big problem here. And I'm sure it works in some countries. But then, all the freight rates and everything else would be fully dictated by the government.
Well, but the point is...
And you don't want that.
But why do you have to? Why would you... You're now going to preference stuff coming from the West to get on your tracks in the East instead of the other guys, if the other guy is more efficient? Why would you want to do that?
Well, if you have... Well, now you're talking about two instead of one, right?
Well, now there's going to be... We're down to three... Well, plus the Canadian National.
You don't want to do that.
Yeah, well, that's...
I mean, that's in general. I mean, that's the short answer, but that's not what's happening. So I was trying to talk about the direction it's going. If you go from three national railroads to two, I think that's more inflationary in the long run than tariffs.
Well, your predecessor...
You go from two from three. Because that's a long-term thing. The tariff is really more of a one-time adjustment, and then you start working off a higher base. But if you have two railroads and you know, there's less competition as far as moving things around, those prices are going to go up.
Why do virtually everybody, how can I say this nicely, Jimmy, because we're going to break here pretty soon, so I'll dodge in a minute. How does everybody with a conservative lean to them of many different intellectual capacities, and most of the people on the show are pretty darn high, and why do they find some way to justify these tariffs, or try to, when there's no justification whatsoever, unless you are actually getting screwed by some country, or in a China situation where they're using child labor and all those other kinds of things, maybe is a way to deal with that. But why does anybody think for a second that this tax increase on your own people, a very regressive tax increase, and you know, the why does anybody think this is a good idea? At the end of the day, we're paying it, and it didn't.
Well, I do believe that there are instances where we may be being taken advantage of by countries, and that, you know, the one I focus on is China, and China, I've never understood the logic, and maybe it's because I have the experience of going over there and doing business with these people. And when they would come and visit the exchange, it was obvious that the people that were visiting the exchange were trying to steal the intellectual property, and that was the only reason they were there. We had to confiscate their phones and everything whenever we took them to any sensitive part of the exchange.
Well, China is a special case. Okay.
Well, they are a special case, but let me, you know, so, you know, we definitely need to do something about that one. But I think when it, you know, everybody gave Trump an awful lot of, gave him a very hard time about renegotiating NAFTA, and saying that we basically had what we had before. But he just, you know, was able to say that maybe he improved it a little bit. I mean, there may have been some areas within NAFTA that did need improving or needed to alter the may favor us a little bit more, et cetera. And this was during his first term. you know, it's everybody getting caught up in, you know, the big sweep around this. But if you're gonna, you know, if you're gonna try to adjust the playing field, and the playing field has been, I do believe the playing field has been less and less and less fair for the United States. I feel like we've been trying to lift the whole world and lift all boats along with us, and that's just if it starts to impact your own house. And you can't take care of all of your neighbors unless you're taking care of yourself. And I think there needs to be a little bit of an adjustment so that you know, things don't automatically favor other countries, and we're not all, and it doesn't appear like we're just trying to take care of other countries. You know, in addition to the tariff thing, you know, there's a big push on everybody in NATO, you know, pulling their fair share. Personally, what I think we should have done instead of saying what we should be doing, instead of saying countries have to spend 5% of their money on defense, just tell them, make blanket payments to us for us to defend you. Because okay. that's in a roundabout way what's been going on.
Okay, well, let's zero in.
I do feel like we've been being taken advantage of by a lot of countries around the world, and this is a way to try to adjust that.
I'm going to
and then finally, you know, the actual tariffs that we're ending up with are so different than the opening shot back in April. And if you look at the stock market chart, it's very obvious that smart people realize pretty quickly that the initial, this is what the tariffs are going to be, wasn't going to be, that was a negotiating tactic. And I'm still, I'm not necessarily in favor of everything that we're trying to do tariff-wise, but I want to see where we land. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to see what he says he's going to do. I want to see where we land. I think the where we landed with Europe was pretty good, as far as we can tell on the surface, the announcement we got over the past, right, you know, the past few days.
You might be.
But the big one's got to be China, and that one just keeps getting pushed out. And that's the one that I wish we were focusing
you
on.
You might be one of the few people, and I don't even know if you did this. Everybody, I think, at least heard of the North American Free Trade Agreement, the NAFTA. Okay, I'm going to say nobody has friggin' read it ever. Nobody has any idea whether or not it was good or bad for us, and it's grown worse or not. And you've got somebody who's a pathological liar, comes out and tells you this is the worst deal on earth. I could have gotten you a better deal. We're getting screwed. Well, if you like the guy, or you realize that you're like just about everybody in this country, your economic situation over the last 20-some years has not kept up, which I think just about nobody's has, unless you got a whole bunch of stock or whatever. And all of a sudden, somebody points the finger at NAFTA, somebody that you voted for, somebody that is in a position to come up with the big lie. I'm going to fix it. All of a sudden, you call people all kinds of names, you redo the thing and say, I fixed it, it's way better, trust me. Nobody read it before, nobody read it after. Nobody knows if he did anything. Except that he's a, and so at the end of the day, you don't really know if you're getting screwed or not. We're having people talk about that places that are screwing us, Switzerland screwing us. Guess what? They don't have any tariffs on anybody, let alone us. How are they screwing us? I mean, Canada, they're screwing us. The average American buys $1,500 worth of crap from Canada. The average Canadian buys $9,000 worth of stuff from us. Tell me how the individual person in Canada is screwing us because Trump said they were. I mean, it's all this constant thing. I didn't know that person was my enemy, and all of a sudden they are.
And everybody was our enemy.
But then again, yeah. I just fixed it. I mean, I don't know whether you fixed it or the way you didn't. I mean, I don't know what you even did other than declare a war, declare a problem that I'm not even sure was there. And oh, by the way, you fixed it. Well, what did you fix? What's better? The whole thing is a sea of crap to me, to be honest with you, which isn't to say that there aren't some places. China, I'm with you. I don't know what the solution there is, Russell, and I think you're probably the smartest one on that. I mean, why do you let the companies that do business in China still do stuff? Why do you let them use, you know, child labor? Why do you let them pollute the damn world?
You know? Yeah, in you know, I hate to deviate too much, but you know, you guys were talking before, and when I was listening before I jumped on, about you know, basically news sources, etc. And I've ended up in an echo chamber with nothing but, you know, on my news feeds with negative stuff about China showing up, and their stock market continues to do okay this year, etc. But you know, I can't think of a fair business practice they engage in.
Well, let me
you know, their safety standards are terrible. Their quality standards are terrible. They steal everything. They steal every piece of intellectual property that they can. They let Tesla in, and then they basically replicate what a Tesla car looks like now.
Well, yeah.
They try to do the same thing with Boeing and everybody else. They do nothing but, you know, they do nothing but lie, steal, and cheat. And we continue. And this is where I was trying to go was, but companies seem to still want to have. I think they're trying to back away now. But for 30 years, I never understood why countries were bending over backwards to, you know, get into the Chinese market, because really is making money there.
Let me back up for you and for Jimmy. I'm going to say the first week Stocks and Jocks was on, or maybe even when John and I were on the score. Matter of fact, I'm sure when John and I were on the score, I set the problem up for China. We're going to go over to triumvirate here. You and me and Jimmy are going to be sitting in the Oval Office one day, and we're the tri-headed presidency. Can you imagine what that would look like? And so we got Bill Gates rushes in. Got to see us. Hey, guess what? These bleeps have bought three things of software, and the last time I checked, they got 400 million computers. Looks to me like they're stealing my software. Well, you got to do something about it. Okay. So we sit there and go, just like you said, Russell, these guys are stealing a bunch of stuff. And all of a sudden, the door breaks open again, and it's the head of Pepsi. Guess what? Or Coke. Guess what? What are you doing? What are you three idiots doing? I'm selling a billion bottles of Pepsi a day to people in China. Don't even think about screwing with these guys. Everybody looked at them as the world's... There was a time they were the world's... We're talking about a market of 1.5 billion people. Everybody couldn't wait to get there. And somebody else is going, okay, I got a union problem here. I'm just going over there. Screw you people here. I'm not paying a living wage when I can go over there and pay for all the rice you can eat all day. The conflict back and forth is, and I don't know that the three of us would be capable of sitting down as, okay, here's a 10-point plan to sort of deal with this. I don't know how we would have started. I don't know what Roosevelt would have done if Hitler would have, you know, held on to his shorts for another 3 years. Everybody here doing business with the guy, and then he attacked people. I mean,
Monday morning quarterbacking is really easy, but you know, you gotta assume that our leaders knew exactly what was going on in that country. If I were president, and there were there's a large, you know, a large manufacturing firm that says they want that we're gonna start outsourcing 50% of what we do in China. I'd bring them to the White House and I would show them how people are treated there, what's really going on over there, and also say, and we're not going to tolerate it for very long. We would strongly encourage that maybe you look somewhere else for your offshore manufacturing. I really would. I would try to give more of an awareness part.
Do you think any of these people care?
And it breaks my heart that they don't. It absolutely just, you know, I don't have the killer instinct that a lot of business people should. Maybe that's why I teach instead of do. But unfortunately, I don't think they do. In fact, I think that all the firms that are redirecting their offshore manufacturing are doing so because they have to, not because they want to, and they're not doing it out of the goodness of their heart. But I bend over backwards to make sure there's nothing that says made in China in it, and when I'm buying stuff, it's very difficult, but I mean that's the little part that I can do. So when just to loop back to the whole tariff thing, I don't think the whole world is screwing us, and I don't think he believed that either. But you got to remember, this guy thinks of himself as, you know, a master and a negotiator and getting deals done and all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, starting out with "you're all screwing us over" is more of an opening shot than anything else. But I'll tell you the funniest thing that I saw. I can't remember what sporting event I was watching, but I was watching a highlight of one of the WNBA games. There was a guy behind one of the benches that was wearing a shirt that said "Make Trade Free Again" in the "Make America Great Again" kind of font, etc. Like, trade was never free.
Well, there's a lot of.
Yeah, I mean, trade was never free.
I'll meet you halfway on this. I'm going to say that if you and I were there, and we would bring Jimmy with. If you and I were there, we'd sense some of these problems. Okay, now.
Yeah.
And I think there's a way to. I just somehow a lot of the stuff the administration is doing, the thing that is really kind of frosting me, is that, and you're a professor, Kevin's a professor, Hal's a professor, we're doing it in an era where we seem to have dumbed down the population to a point where you're talking to people. What percentage of the population, especially in MAGA land, think that the tariff is on them and not us? I'm going to say 85%. What do you think, Jimmy?
Mm-hmm. I would say you're really close on that one. Definitely above 80.
How many people even know that? And how many people know that all revenue bills are supposed to start in the House, and that tariffs in the Constitution are the property of Congress, and Congress has given the ability to the executive branch, and I don't know the law that much, but in emergency situations to do something. Anybody who thinks that the entire world, what he's doing is an emergency situation, is out of their mind. And the idea that this could go down as the biggest tax increase, certainly in my lifetime, and I'm thinking ever, and none of it came out of Congress. I got a real problem with that, Russell. I mean, I think...
Well, and you say it could. Again, I'm waiting to see what the final product is.
But what's the difference? I mean, the idea is you do as everyone want, one guy being Mr. Swashbuckler. Now, I think what would happen is I would hope that if it was the three of us, and I don't know, I've never been to Camp David, I don't know how big it is, but I'd like to grab 5-6 people on both sides of the aisle, both houses of Congress, and show up and say, all right, guys, here's where our statistics show. We in good faith, put this NAFTA deal together with, say, Mexico. And we knew people were going to be paid $3 an hour in the Chevy plant there when our guys are making 25. Mm-hmm. The theory was that they would be like America, which nobody is, be like America, and by now they should be making $12 an hour or $15 an hour, to where now they're evening up somewhat, to where now they are customers and they're buying our stuff, where we have advantages and capital and power and stuff that they don't have. They have a labor advantage. Okay, now two questions is, do you push the labor advantage to the point where you got 12-year-olds working there in China? Well, no, you can't have that happen. But now we're going to sit there and say, guys, and by the way, Russell, you'd be my lead man talking about this because you're the brightest on this. How is it that after 25 years, instead of making $12 an hour, they're still making $3.50? What has happened? Now, is it the government in China, I mean, putting their fingers on the original theory was that if you opened up the economy, you'd open up the politics. Well, that has not worked in China. Now, what's going on in Mexico? Is General Motors paying the gangs to stop people from striking, to stop people from demanding more money? I don't know if that's true or not, but I'd want to know. Theoretically, we shouldn't be here. Why are we? And before I start,
well, first off, the government keeps people from protesting.
Okay, but I'm saying
that's not an alternative
in China.
In China, and you know what? That's why they put nets around the Foxconn building.
What I'm saying is, I would like you're my expert on China. So now let's start with closer Mexico. Why aren't they making $15 an hour? And we know they have more people.
And you know what? And just to really just kind of close a giant circle on the whole thing, if NAFTA was so darn good for Mexico, why do people keep trying to come across our border? Well, and I know a lot of those people are not coming from Mexico. They're coming through Mexico. But still.
Okay, but
it didn't. And I'm wondering, you know, the Obama, actually, when you talk about migrants or undocumented immigrants or whatever term you want to use for, he deported 3 million. He deported tons. And then Trump came in, and it wasn't really a problem. And Trump did renegotiate NAFTA.
Now, when you say...
And hold on, Link. Yeah. It's a progression. And then everybody says that Joe Biden's been letting all these undocumented immigrants in. It wasn't an adjustment of NAFTA that made things so difficult for Mexico that suddenly people are trying to flood in here. You know, was that a cause of what ended up happening over the long run? Or was it just Joe Biden could have cared less that all these people were crossing the border? I can't believe that anybody cared less that everybody was crossing the border. So, you know, maybe there was something somewhat unfavorable about NAFTA. And when we renegotiated it, it just crushed Mexico. I don't know.
Do you know how you know how the people coming across the border, you know how they get counted?
Each time they come across.
Okay. What do you mean by each time they come across?
I know the year the White Sox won the World Series, my wife and I went to 22 regular season games, and they didn't lose a single one. We take credit for them winning the World Series that year. But does that mean that 44 different people went to White Sox games, or two different people went to 22 different White Sox games? It's the same thing.
No.
You know, where you got the same person being counted, four or five times.
The people that they count are the people they caught and sent back.
Yeah.
So
that's why I'm saying you got the same person multiple times.
But so the number of how many people you didn't catch, the one that Trump especially likes to talk out there, the 20 million or whatever number he comes up with off the top of his dome, that's, if anything, it's based on the people you caught and sent back. You don't know the people that got through. How could you know they got through?
You do. I think there is an awareness of people that have overstayed their visas, et cetera.
No, that's different.
But that's not a border crisis. So that is a number that you can kind of back into.
Right, and that number is not the same number.
You know, No, it's not. I'm just the people that snuck through and I just don't know how you live your life day to day. My assumption is some people employ people, you know, are willing to cash employ people, but I sure wouldn't want to be trying to get by on that.
When I first started on the trading floor 40 some years ago, I'm going to say that there was a lot of that going on in every restaurant, every place.
I used to wait tables at Burnham Park Yacht Club, and the whole kitchen was let's just say they came in the country for only 4 months and then went back.
Every private
country. And I don't think they were supposed to be working, and I kind of wish I had named the place.
I'm going to say every private country club. Well, you know the place, what was it? Help me here, Jimmy. It was the something steakhouse or chop house. The real big place on LaSalle that became Michael Jordan's, and now it's something else. The real big restaurant.
It wasn't just Chicago Chop House, was it?
No, I think it was Ireland's. Was the name of the place.
Okay.
Well, when you went, this is before it was Michael Jordan's, and when you went by there,
it was Bigsby and something before Michael Jordan's.
Okay. Well, there was you could see everybody. They were all, everyone was living upstairs.
Yeah.
You could mean they were just sitting on the windows. And if you went to
let's throw a non-Chicagoan under the bus. I had a couple of buddies from my fraternity that owned a Chinese restaurant in Memphis, and I had a financial interest in it. Everybody that worked there was illegal and paid with cash, and we rented two apartments about a block and a half away for them to live in, and they would come here for a couple of years and then go back to China. And this is like the 90s, when China really hadn't started to modernize like it did. And they were paid in cash. This is my favorite part. They all went on strike once, and they struck. And when they were asked what they wanted, they said Sopranos. They went on strike so that we would add HBO to the cable in their apartment.
Good for them. Hey, it was a good show.
We want Sopranos.
You know what?
And it like took us a minute to figure out what the hell they wanted.
I'm gonna do for him something I think he'd never do for me. But I actually played it to Durrell.
Oh, okay.
But this is before Trump owned it. So I'm gonna be nice to him and say it was before he owned it. I don't think he would do the same to me. Just curious. But I tell you what, I'm gonna say I'll take the under on every person I saw working on a course as being a citizen.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm absolutely sure.
And God, was it hot down there. God, was it hot.
Again, everybody keeps bringing up the tariff thing, and my whole attitude about it has been, and it drives the PR person helly nuts because they get so many inquiries about wanting a professor to talk about the impact of the tariffs, etc. I'm not talking about it until I see how it ends up. You know,
whatever it is, the thing is, you can't give. On one hand, if you like the people, you roll with this, and I'll say something like, I mean, I tell the people on the show that are all conservative. I'll say they're talking about $660 billion in taxes. And now I'm going to say, because I probably know more about tariffs than Trump does, it's never going to be that high. It's never going to be that high.
No, it's not. But, it's not. And
but the thing of it is, I can say that because I'm sort of in the middle and I'm willing to cut the guy a break. But the fact is, it's not going to be nothing. And a guy who's smart enough like you is going to say, well, I'm going to wait and see where it is because I'm too smart to use their stupid number. But what if it's half that? That's one hell of a tax increase. A regressive tax increase, right?
Yeah.
And maybe some people on this end, when it all settles out, because right now I think all of us on the show are in agreement. Nobody, based on the on-again, off-again crap for the last 6 months, nobody, if you got an ounce of brains, is going to go to the bank, borrow money to build a factory because you think it's going to help you and bring people back here. Nobody's willing to do that.
Right. Right.
Now, maybe you're going to get some investment from another company that comes in, or another country, which would be a good thing, by the way. Somebody would come in and build a $600 million place because you're giving them so many advantages that they can't not do it. Maybe that'll happen, and I'm all for it. But the way it's being handled, if the ultimate goal is for people here to sense a change in the world to where now we can manufacture this stuff here with using real labor laws and those kinds of things, I don't think anybody's has gotten that message yet to where they're going to start. Mm-hmm. So if that's your actual goal, I think you're not there yet. Now,
no.
But at the end of the day, if the number's 330 or 220 or 440 instead of 660, you wouldn't believe the abuse I get, literally, for using their number. Oh, yeah, so you know it's not that number. Well, I'm using their number. I didn't say it. They did. I mean, I don't think it's going to be that. But what if it was that, for God's sake? A $660 billion tax increase not going through Congress? You okay with that?
I'm not okay with that, but I don't think that's what it's ultimately going to be.
Okay, but I'm saying...
I just don't think that's what it's ultimately going to be.
Let me ask you, you and I have been buddies forever, and hopefully always will be forever. If I went out and said something like, you know, 40% of the professors at which I would never say, 40% of the professors at Indiana have been to whatever Epstein's Island. And first of all, that's I don't think anybody from Indiana has been to their island. But why, if I said something like that, even you would say, what's the matter with the chief? He's a moron today. Yet with this guy, he doesn't really mean that. He means it like one or two. Why do some people have other people constantly make it their job to say what they say and then say this is what they really meant and tone it down? Why can't you just take what somebody says as what they say?
That's part of that whole negotiating tactic thing. It really is. Unfortunately.
Well, I mean, I would
love it if we could, if we, you know, and again, I sometimes I think I've been too naive around these types of situations in my life, but you know, that it's just, unfortunately, it's just the direction that we've gone, where you just, you know, people aren't as honest as they used to be.
But I'm just,
you know what I mean? And I think it's a nature of how we interact with each other, et cetera.
But it's all,
this is like a whole hour long discussion about how, you know, if I want to say something truly nasty with somebody on the internet, I've had people, because I'm a pseudo, you know, especially when I was at SIBO, I was kind of a pseudo public person. I said something about dicks that upset somebody so much, they wrote a whole comment thing on the SIBO website about me being a child molester and a pedophile.
Because you didn't like Vicks?
Yeah, where the hell did that come from? But yeah, because I said that Vicks was giving a concerning signal about the overall markets.
So,
And citing history. And, you know, I had to call the IT people on the weekend and say, we got to take this thing down. Look at what this person said. But you know, I think there is some of that, you know, the discourse, you used to be, if I was going to insult you, I was going to have to find you, and I was going to have to do it face to face. And if you didn't like what I said, I was going to have to deal with the repercussions, which could include getting punched in the nose, maybe justifiably so. I can say something nasty in a public forum about anybody in the world right now, and I could probably, you know, I could open up a new Twitter account and do something like that, and no repercussions whatsoever. And we've got a whole generation that has had that ability, and I think it's messing around with just the way that we interact with each other.
So all the people at PTI that have traded the VIX in the last few years, do I need to call them up and say, by the way, are you a pedophile?
Well, if they say that, when the 50-day moving average crosses over the 200-day moving average on VIX, that's a negative signal for the S&P 500. Yeah, because that's all I said.
I don't.
And I got, I know. It's the point is that we've reached a point where it's just the discourse is so extreme, and you can, and the president does it. He's all over Twitter saying ridiculous stuff.
Yeah, but how do you raise a family telling kids not to use words like stupid and stuff when the president's doing it?
It's very difficult, but you highlight that you know, regardless that he, you know, that he's not exactly a good role model as far as public discourse goes.
Yeah, I got to ask you a question.
Pretty much, you know what, or pretty much anything else. Now that about it, I mean, I personally do believe that some of the things that he's trying to accomplish will be good for us long term.
I do too.
I just, for God's sake, dude, tone it down.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe he doesn't feel like he has to tone it down because there's, you know, 49% of the country that is immediately going to hate anything. You know, the guy could, you know, cure cancer, solve all the economic problems for the whole world, everything else, and there's still going to be 49% of the country that just can't stand him.
Well,
you know,
I mean,
and if it reaches that point, you know, if regardless of what you say, you're never going to, you know, you're never going to really convince the folks that already are against you, why even try?
Well, I mean, Lyndon Johnson was not a good guy. I mean,
no, he was not a good guy.
Hey, I have a question for you, an economics question.
You got to go quick because I didn't have a chance to let you know ahead of time, but I've got a hard stop. I've got a.
All right. Well, I don't know if you looked at
somebody's going to call me. So go quick. It hasn't happened, but I got like a minute to answer.
M2. Last month, we just got the numbers. It's now we're now pushing 7.5% yearly gain, which obviously that's why the market's going up in my mind. We're and the valuations are to the point where they're higher than they were in 99, 2000. I'm just lobbing it out there in some of the bigger stacks. Are we going to be at a 10% money supply grain? Are we talking about a 10% inflation? And where does this end? Right now, there's no end. The more they put in, the better things look. The more the market goes up.
And you know, and what it, one of the phrases that I think we avoid when we're in a forum like this is liquidity. And because it's kind of it's not intuitive to people that aren't paying attention to the financial markets all the time, but you know, money is kind of like water. It's got to find somewhere to go, and one of the better places for it to go in a lot of people's minds, especially when the S&P 500 is making new highs, you know, on a fairly regular basis, is the stock market. And that's true globally as well. And we're not the only ones that are increasing our money supply. China's been doing it faster than we have, believe it or not. Yep. And they've got they have deflation. It's not even helping them. But that's what's going on with the stock market. Liquidity's got to find a place somewhere. You can only buy so much crap, and actually we're going to have less crap that we're going to be able to buy. That's becoming, yeah. We're already seeing some supply chain issues around that. In fact, that's what I have to jump off in a minute to talk about.
All right, but why don't you jump off? I got to call all my clients that trade VIX and ask them if they're a pedophile.
Okay, yeah, well, you do a double check on them with that. And remember, Elon Musk called somebody that as well. I wonder if that's where that came from.
Oh, God.
Remember the guy that was going to rescue the people that were stuck in a hole, and Elon Musk wanted to help over in Thailand or something, and when the guy said he didn't want his help, he called him a few really bad names about a decade or so ago.
That's unreal. All right, bud, you take care of yourself.
No. You betcha.
SP Futures up 5, NASDAQ Futures up 37. We got the Fed this afternoon. We'll be talking about that tomorrow. And oh, by the way, we got the labor numbers on Friday, so it's a big week. But back tomorrow. Jimmy, thank you. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.